This is Personal Political from the nonfiction audio storytelling class.
Personal Political, Episode 3, Disclosure.
Different Drummers by Aidan Owens.
I'm in my car, getting ready to leave for the hour and a half drive to Worcester for my African drumming rehearsal. I'm part of the WPI African Percussion and Dance Ensemble. We play West African music, specifically the polyrhythmic drumming of the Ewe people from southern Ghana, Togo, and Benin. I never planned to fall in love with this music, but after traveling to the Volta region of Ghana to study with the master drummers at the Dagbe Cultural Institute and Arts Center, I caught the bug, as my teacher says. I've always loved music. I began playing classical piano when I was 3, then came many other instruments and genres. Ukulele, guitar, drums, banjo, folk, rock, punk. And now, West African percussion. I took a West African drum class for a year, and then I went to Ghana. Now I study, learn, perform, and teach Ewe music. I listen to and read everything I can. I teach Ewe music to my students at Berkshire Hills Music Academy. This will be the focus of my senior thesis, and I'm looking into ethnomusicology graduate programs. I'm not Ewe, but Ewe music is my passion. Of some challenges for me. Issues of authenticity and, most notably, appropriation. Cultural appropriation is a term to describe the taking over of creative or artistic forms, themes, or practices by one cultural group from another. It usually refers to Westerners adopting aspects of non-Western cultures and carries connotations of exploitation and dominance. I've thought a lot about cultural appropriation in various contexts, especially since coming to Hampshire and beginning my studies in ethnomusicology. Is what I'm doing, playing African music as a white American, cultural appropriation? I love Ewe music. The polyrhythms, time signatures, and the way the various drum parts all fit together intrigues me. The use of oral tradition to teach and pass on this music piques my interest as a student, musician, and budding ethnomusicologist. The way the conversations happening between the drums translate to the dancers' vivid motions and the way the music holds meaning all speak to me. I recently put together a performance of an Ewe social song called Gahu for the Hampshire College Music Department's Spring 2016 Works in Progress concert. I gathered a group of my peers, some who had experience with the music and some who hadn't, and taught them the song. At one of the rehearsals, a fellow ethnomusicology student told me that playing this music as a white person was inherently cultural appropriation, regardless of my intention behind it. I kind of had a bit of an existential crisis when I heard this. Was I doing my Ghanaian teachers and friends a disservice by studying and performing their music? I'd set out to honor the music and bring it to audiences that may not be familiar with it, but was what I was doing inherently bad? I asked my teacher. He's also not Ewe, but he studied extensively in Ghana and with Ghanaian teachers in America. He doesn't agree with the premise that people should or shouldn't do something based on their skin color or place of origin. At Dagbe, my Ghanaian teacher said the same thing. They love that people came from all over the world to study their music and culture. But so many people disagree. So many people would say that what I'm doing is cultural appropriation. Is my passion for Ewe music just another musical endeavor, or is it cultural appropriation? I don't know. Maybe I'll never know. But it's time to head out for rehearsal, so.
Instead of Silence by Iona Pearl Reed Eaton. If we are silent about our pain, they will kill us and say we enjoyed it. Zora Neale Hurston. The substance of this piece lies in experiences of trauma, particularly rape, and how we do or don't deal with them. The experiences recollected in this piece are ones I think about every day without fail, and I expect to replay them in my mind every day for the rest of my life. Not that I want to. I wish they didn't affect me to the extent that they do, but that's how trauma works. No matter how deep you've buried it, no matter how healed you think you are, it's always there. This piece depicts an acid trip gone wrong and sexual assault, both physically violent as well as drunk and dissociated. I also discuss alcohol abuse and flashbacks. Please listen cautiously. Post-traumatic stress disorder self-test. If you suspect that you might suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, complete the following self-test by clicking the yes or no boxes next to each question. If you have experienced trauma and have answered yes to some of these questions, discuss them with your doctor. Have you experienced or witnessed a life-threatening event that caused intense fear, helplessness, or horror? Do you re-experience the event in at least one of the following ways? Repeated distressing memories and or dreams? Acting or feeling as if the event were happening again? Flashbacks or a sense of reliving it? Intense physical and or emotional distress when you are exposed to things that remind you of the event? More days than not, do you feel sad or depressed? Part 1. Where did you sleep last night? I didn't have many friends growing up. It's always been easy for me to put up a front. Oddly, as the daughter of two actors, I'm much better at pretending offstage than I am on. Iona Pearl, how are you so happy all the time? Somehow, a question that seemed harmless hurt more than if it were an insult, because it meant that they didn't see me. They didn't see how close I was to giving up. But shortly after arriving at Hampshire, I had an insta-family. I felt safe, I had friends, college was fun, yippee! A few weeks into my first year, a friend of a friend was tripping on acid and became very violent while in my room. The events that unfolded marked the first major trauma that seriously impeded my ability to function. I threw up for the first time in 10 years because my flashbacks were so intense. I carried a knife with me around campus, and I couldn't sleep alone. I had never felt like I deserved friendship, and as I failed to properly cope with the events of that October night, I felt like a burden on my friends. Like I was too much. Too much to handle, too much to deal with. The worst thing about being too much is that it also means you're not enough. Part 2, Negative Creep. Sunday, October 4th, 2015, 2310 hours, Rooster at Huss. I am in my mind all the time, and it is not always an escape. I want so badly for it to be a place I can rely on for solace, but it's hard when it is also the place that seems so often to be reliving my trauma. Rape is such a violent word. Even though what happened to me was violent, I'm always so aware of what people will think when they hear certain words. Trauma is feeling like a good word for helping me contextualize this experience. The weight, but also the ambiguity of trauma feels good, and I feel safe in using it to describe my experiences. The summer after my first year of college, I had sex with a penis for the first time. The morning after, the guy I was with, let's call him Adic, because that's what he was, asked me to do a certain sexual act. No, I don't want to. I really think you should. It'd be a nice gift, something for me to remember you by. No, I don't give a shit. I don't want to. Please stop trying to make me. But I really want you to. My final no was muffled by Adic's physical force as he overpowered me. Whenever I've heard people who haven't been assaulted talk about how they would react if they were assaulted, they usually say something along the lines of, if anyone ever tried to rape me, I would fight them off. I would claw at them and scream, and I would outrun them. But that's bullshit. That's not how rape works, and that's not how trauma works. No one knows how they'll react to a traumatic event until it happens. Someone can be as prepared as possible, and when experiencing trauma, completely dissociate and lose the ability to react in any defensive way. After Adic assaulted me, I was so afraid and confused that I pretended everything was fine. He walked me to my car, and I kissed him goodbye. At the time, the FBI's definition of rape was still the carnal knowledge of a female forcibly and against her will. It has since been amended to have no mention of gender or force. My experience was very forced and very much against my will. I knew what it was, but I was too afraid to name it. Even now it's difficult. Why is saying I was raped so scary when it's not something that I asked for or wanted to happen? Why do I carry so much shame when I did nothing wrong? The next week, when I was hooking up with a new person, I blurted, I had sex for the first time last week and he made me do things I didn't want to do. And he said, I just got divorced because my wife cheated on me with my best friend. Pause. Not really the same thing, but both are shitty things to have happen to you. We're both broken, I exclaimed. We high-fived. After that, though, I locked it away and didn't talk about it. I don't have time to deal with this, I thought. Newsflash, trauma doesn't give a fuck about your schedule. Part 3. Hurt. Therapy, 4 p.m. In our session today, Christy said, you have to let yourself feel things, Iona Pearl. You are allowed to feel angry, sad, whatever. You won't be able to move on from anything if you don't let yourself feel things. I keep feeling this huge tension in my chest, like I'm seconds away from falling apart, cracking open like an egg. I was raped by my best friend on October 17th, 2015, my 21st birthday. I woke up in his bed and I felt a sickness that had nothing to do with the alcohol I'd consumed the night before. I couldn't remember much, but I felt ashamed, disgusting, and terrified. Even if you can't remember something or find the words to describe it, the body is always a resource. When I talked to him about it later, things got emotional. He got emotional. Me. You knew how drunk I was. Him. But you were so cuddly. Me. You knew I would say no if sober. I wanted to scream at him. I wanted to replay for him one of the few parts of the previous night that I remembered. when I mustered the strength to chant, "I don't want to sleep here. I don't want to sleep here. I don't want to sleep here." I had said sleep while what I really wanted to say was be. I couldn't say be because to say be would bring to his attention the fact that he was betraying me. To say be would cause this person, whom I had vowed never to hurt, to feel bad because of something he did to me. Just as intensely, I wanted to choke him. I wanted to make him feel like I had felt the night before. Make him try to scream, but hear no sound. Make him try to move his arms, sit up, anything, but his body not listen. Make him feel like he was drowning. And then I wanted to make him feel the way I felt then, and would for months to come. Make him feel like he was suffocating. Make him feel like no one saw how hurt he was. Make him feel ashamed, disgusting, unworthy, unwanted. But I couldn't. I couldn't because before I got the chance, he began to cry. He began to cry, and though he was the harmer and I was the harmed, I couldn't feel my feelings anymore. I wasn't allowed to. He began to cry, and my first thought was to comfort him, to make his hurt go away. And then I remembered what he'd done. I looked at this person whom I had loved but never wanted, and I said, as evenly as I could, "I need you to leave." Afterwards, I needed to explain it away. There had to be a reason why my best friend had sexually assaulted me. Some of my explanations concerned my character. Maybe this happened because I like sex too much. That's a thing, right? I don't want it to be a thing, but maybe it's a thing. Maybe this is retribution for hooking up with one too many... Oh, fuck. I shouldn't lie here. 1, 2, 3... Maybe this is retribution for hooking up with 3 too many boys whose girlfriends didn't want them hooking up with other girls. Side note, I'm not a good person. But I knew then, and I know now, that rape is not a punishment for being a bad person or for hurting people. Some of my explanations concern my drinking habits. I think you might be an alcoholic, Iona Pearl. I mean, this obviously happened because you were drinking, Iona Pearl. You should definitely stop. But I didn't. In the months that followed, I drank all the time. I was in bed 15 hours a day, every day, in an attempt to shield myself. I had nightmares all the time, and I often woke up yelling, "I don't want to be here, I don't want to be here, I don't want to be here." Once again, I didn't know how to deal. How could I be expected to face the world when someone I had trusted so fully could so easily commit an act of violence against me and justify it because I was cuddly? I am so fucking tired. As someone who's been socialized as female, I've been taught never to trust my feelings. I've been taught that when a boy yanks my ponytail at recess or spits on me in class, it's because he has a crush on me, and that I should not take offense. I've been taught that if I go on a date with a guy and it doesn't go well, I should give him another chance, even if he makes me uncomfortable. I've been taught to be polite when gas station clerks leer and ask if I'm legal, even if my only purchase is coffee. I've been taught that every reaction I have is an overreaction. I am so fucking tired. That I am ambiguously brown, that I'm small in stature, and my voice high in tone only add to my feelings of trepidation as I attempt to minimize the space I take up. I feel as though the world is constantly trying to convince me that my body is not my own, that my body belongs to anyone who reaches for my waist in a club, that my body's worth is only accurately determined when I'm catcalled, a practice that also works to remind me that if I give anyone a reason, whether it be my dress, my facial expression, my gait, my attempts to retort, they are capable of punishing me as they see fit. I'm so fucking tired. I'm tired of screaming and nobody hearing. I'm tired of yelling and nobody listening. I'm tired of showing and nobody seeing. I'm tired of being afraid.
following piece contains sensitive material related to eating disorders and domestic violence. The segment will last 11 minutes and 19 seconds. The Lineaments of Appetite by Maggie Weiler. I can't stop probing it with my tongue. The wedge of empty space where bone used to be. My tongue searches furiously. I bet I'm hiding in there. When did it fall out? I'm not feeling any pain. That hunk of bone is floating in my stomach like meteor debris in space. It's going to slice me open. I will start bleeding out. I am bleeding out. I see the orange crimson swirls. Like spin art. Psychedelic. Psychotic. I'm not feeling any pain, but I know that I'm dying. Soon my body will distend with blood. I'll keel over from my haunches. Someone will find me here, curled up like dried citrus rinds. I won't let them find me before I've gotten it all out. I remember the first time I starved myself. I was with my friend Mei Ying at school, leaning against the lockers, admiring my hip bones, and I told her I hadn't eaten anything in 2 days. Triumphantly. Mostly I wanted to share this discovery I'd made, that a person could refashion themselves by muting their appetite. I was expecting to hear some kind of praise from her, but she looked at me with censure. "That's really bad for you," she told me. So from then on I kept it all to myself. There aren't really any photos of me growing up. I avoided having my fatness documented at all costs. Once, my parents had just gotten a series of pictures developed from a trip we had taken to Greece a few months before. I was slipping through them and landed on one of a few that I had let my mother take of me. There I was, smiling with my sister at a restaurant table. I remember the bread I ate that night. I recognized that I looked like what people would call a pretty girl. I erupted into tears. The body I looked at the picture with felt monstrous to me. Oozing, infectious, disgusting, abject. "I didn't think I looked like that," I heard myself say. My mother looked over my shoulder at the picture, unaffected. "Yeah, Mag, that's you."
"Okay, black coffee is 5 calories plus 1. Apple is 90 calories plus 1 light and fit yogurt is 80 calories.
My body was supposed to be void and compact and sylph-like. If I existed, it would be confirmed by the boys who watched me ripening and the girls who watched them watching and watched each other being watched. Our bodies were to be desirable but undesiring and innocent to the desire of others. I knew all about desire, veracity. But I did not desire the way everyone else seemed to. I could not mute my appetite. I could not exile it from my body, but I was convinced that it was the most mutant, grotesque, and most animal part of me. The same for the way I wanted to be touched. The hands and mouths I felt my body careen towards. About a year into predominantly starving, I started punctuating stretches of hunger by gorging myself.
Constellation of calluses and bruises embossed on the back of my hand in the shape of a crescent or my jaw.
It was late fall 2013, and my body, a heap of prongs and skin, was lying crumpled on the floor in a pile of unwashed clothes.
A serrated front tooth like a miniature Dover cliff. Eroded by cycling tides of gastric acid.
Filled with dread, I reached for my cell phone.
The architecture of my hallowed body.
I had not returned any of my parents' desperate voicemails in a long time.
Hollow enough for echoes.
The few times I had gone outdoors that week, my body had let go of me like a balloon.
Bones, an ivory mobile that could barely brace a gust of wind.
I felt myself drifting above everything.
Valiantly weathered tongue.
Place, space, time.
Miraculous oscillations of my stomach.
Talking to people was an act of ventriloquism.
The enlightenment reached at the end of every cycle.
I expected it would feel the same way when I talked to my parents.
Floating up into the ether as it begins again.
Listening to the line ring. They answered, and I heard myself saying words I had not said to anyone. But I was so afraid, so lonely, and that I was rejecting every kind of nourishment needed by a living thing, from light to company to rest to food. There are a lot of rules about behavior on the eating disorder unit of the New York State Psychiatric Institute. When you will eat, how you will eat, what you will eat, where you will eat, where you're allowed to go, what you're allowed to do, when you go there, how long you're allowed to do it for,
what you're allowed to discuss,
where you're allowed to discuss it. There aren't any rules about feelings, though. You're entitled to those. The one I felt most strongly there was anger or indignation, which was a sensation I'd lost the ability to recognize myself feeling. My eating disorder became a repository for this energy. Behavior became a substitute for the feeling. So when I could no longer engage the behavior, I found there was nowhere to put it all. My family has dinner together every night, and I could probably count on one hand the number of times all five of us were still sitting at the table by the end of the meal. It's variations on a theme of chaos every night. The opening ceremonies begin when my mother says, like a dejected child, "Can't we just have one night where we don't fight?" Washing down that family slogan with another glug of wine. The volume is always high. Conversations are always combative. Humor is plentiful and lavish, and everything always escalates. I remember once my brother couldn't take the verbal bludgeoning anymore, so he surged up from the table, jutting his steak knife out at my father, and his body slackened in a way I'd never seen before. Seeing my dad, his remoteness and reserve liquefy like that made something deep inside me dislodge. No matter how mild or violent dinner is on any given night, my mother always proceeds through a sequence I only started to consciously notice after I had my first drink when I was 14. Her eyelids hunker down further and further. Her words crowd closer and closer together. Her shoulders slouch deeper and deeper until she can barely hold herself up anymore and has to retire to her bed. The next morning, we all wake up. No one mentions anything that happened the night before. It's like nothing happened, no matter how much we scare or hurt each other. Maybe I made it all up in my head. I can afford to sustain this illness. My whiteness makes it a little more possible. My gender tells me to prove it. My body looks able on the outside. My country looks rich and forested, and all the waste I've generated is kept invisible in an artificial ecosystem. This sickness cannot be feminist, anti-capitalist, decolonial, queer, environmentalist, creative, tender, radical. The only thing I had by the root was my esophagus. I'm complicit, complacent. This is a fraud. And I do open my eyes, and I am awake, and I am having a nightmare. I remember the happiest I ever was in the morning. It was August 2014, and I was in the woods. I didn't know or care how long I'd been running, how many calories I'd shaken off. I felt my body slow and veer off the dirt path where the earth met the river. The canopy of leaves was shattering, shifting sunlight over the water. My breath, which had become its own soaring organism, was beginning to nestle back into my chest. and I listened to it subside into a murmur, the sound entwining with the wind and the birds, the whispering water. A month ago, I would not have been able to fathom the place I was in now, standing in the woods, both alone and with myself, listening and breathing. I felt myself being cradled by the world and marveled at the miracle of being able to withstand this tenderness. And then I felt my heart spill over and flood a body that had learned to cherish itself. And as I cried, a smile burst across my face, like the beginning of a universe. Like the quiet miracle of seeing the sun come out while it's still raining. Examination by Flannery Rollins.
Happiness is consistently described as the object of human desire, as being what we aim for, as being what gives purpose, meaning, and order to human life. Do we consent to happiness? What are we consenting to when we consent to happiness? So it's 7 a.m. and I woke up on my own without an alarm. I do that sometimes. I'm not really sure why. My body jolts awake and I never fall back asleep. I sit here in my own bed instead of my girlfriend's. I breathe and smell my own skin instead of her hair. I push the blanket aside and place my feet to the tile. Today is different from the last, but only slightly. I promised my therapist I would take time in the morning to write in my journal, or meditate, or exercise. I'm supposed to bring myself present, centered, focused. Instead, I ate breakfast. Sugary cereal is easy. Bits of scrambled eggs with ketchup and extra pepper keep me full. On days when I wake up and feel like dying, I cook omelets. Variations of red onions with bacon and shredded cheddar I even do the dishes. In a daydream, a voice asks me, "Are you a happy person?" And I reply, "Well, that's a very complex question." And she says, "It's a yes or no question." And I say, "I read somewhere I'm supposed to let you in.
You're a failure. It's all a trick. You aren't a good person. You are unhappy. There's something wrong with you. What's wrong with you? You don't write enough. You're not really a lesbian. You're never going to be okay. You don't even know what that word means anymore. You're a failure. It's all a trick. You're not a good person. You are unhappy. There's something wrong with you. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?
I am not a performance. My daily routine is not extraordinary. I am not a performance. My daily routine is not extraordinary. I think too much. I don't write enough. There is still so much left to read. I write a reminder on my bookmark. Don't cancel therapy this week. I spend hours in the library. I touch paper and carry my finger across lines of sentences. Sarah Ahmed's The Promise of Happiness lies in my lap. I note-take with blue ink on a small yellow legal pad. The ink turns green. I stare at my cursive scribble. Individual happiness becomes a form of structural evidence. Example, the American dream. Discussion of happiness allows certain things to be thinkable or unthinkable. It allows the blame to fall on yourself instead of power. Happiness creates stability in an unstable world. Happiness is supposed to be normal. I stare some more. Some of the ink has bled through to the second page, and some of it is on the side of my hand. With the same pen, I stare at the margins, empty except for a few scattered circle doodles. I write down what I'm thinking. I am an unhappy person. I'm sitting on the side of the tub while the bathroom fills with steam. This warmth feels good, feels soft, feels fine. In search for more warmth, I step into the bathtub, my skin glowing warm, pink and smoldering. I work hard. I take a bath. I let the day burn. I try again tomorrow.
So thank you. That was episode 3. And just sitting in the after glow of those pieces, which went really deep. So I'm sitting here with two of the producers from that episode. And Iona Pearl, I wanted to ask you a question first, awkwardly perched here, about your piece, Instead of Silence. You gave voice to things that our culture often does encourage to keep silent. And I'm curious how it felt for you to opt for voicing rather than silence in your audio piece.
I think that I didn't really feel like I had a choice in that we had to do something personal, and there's not a lot, like, I can't, like I say in my intro, like, these are things that I think about all the time, that I'm reliving constantly, that will affect me for the rest of my life. Like, I only realized through doing this that, like, I don't leave the door to my room open, like, ever, really, and that's because I had this traumatic incident where someone, like, tripped in my room and was very violent, and I'm trying to protect myself against that happening again.
And was it, Andrea had posed the question to earlier producers today, was there any, how did it feel for you to make this piece and then also now to hear it? Was there a sense of healing and or other feelings that have come up for you?
Making this piece, it was something, like, especially the assaults, I hadn't really written, or I kind of had written some about, so I, like, went back and looked at my journals, and that was really horrible, because I saw, like, how much I tried to excuse away these experiences, and, like, not trust my feelings, but it felt like something I had to do. It felt like something that future me would appreciate, and I think that it has, like, it made me realize, like, I have PTSD, and, like, not that I'll change any of the things I do for healing because of that, but just, like, recognizing that these feelings exist is important for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. And Maggie, your piece is called Lineaments of Appetite. And similar questions for you about, I guess, just what has this process of making the piece been like for you? I've watched you go through, again, like everyone, a lot of different versions of this and really engage deeply. I'm curious how it has been for you to make it.
Well, I think Andrea mentioned this in the previous episode. She mentioned whether there's a therapeutic element to putting together a piece like this. And for me, there definitely was. But I think that in, at least in my recovery and in this kind of mental illness, there's not always a lot of space. Like, it vacillates from day to day how much space there is between the present and the past in terms of, like, symptoms, because it's really hard to distinguish between, like, maladaptive mental patterns and behaviors sometimes. And this piece took a while to make. I mean, we've been working on this for a long period of time, so it definitely varied from day to day. So sometimes it was really difficult. I also went back and reviewed some, like, diary entries that I had to get closer to the kind of language that I was using to experience these things. But yeah, it was a lot of, like, retracing my steps and having to negotiate the tension between what's rehashing stuff that doesn't need to be rehashed and being honest. So, yeah.
Right. For both of you, you're going so, like, you really embrace the spirit of this assignment by going in two directions at once, one very deeply internal, into that intimate space, and at the same time into a very political space. And I think each piece in the whole course, everyone has navigated that a little bit differently, but I'm wondering how you feel, both of you, about the political significance or insignificance of having these voices and these stories, and specifically you two, in the air. What do you think about the politics of having this story now in the air, Iona Pearl?
Well, right now, April is Sexual Assault Activism Month. I guess it's May now. Doesn't matter. But so there's a lot of stuff going on Hampshire campus around sexual assault and Title IX and how the college deals with accusations, allegations of sexual assault on campus. And I think I participated in someone's Division III, which was also about these experiences, and I did a series of photographs. And I've just been realizing more and more, like, how much not telling people was affecting my life, like how much this experience affected me, and then I wasn't able to talk to anyone about it, or like explain why I wasn't able to do stuff that people can usually do. I don't know. I think that it doesn't, just because it's my life, it doesn't feel like it's a political thing. Because I don't really feel, like, again, I don't really feel like I have the option to not talk about it because I have such privilege that I go to this school and I can make projects like this. And there are a lot of folks who have similar experiences who can't.
Thanks.
Sure. I agree. I think that there's a lot of privilege in being able to expose any of the accounts or stories that have been divulged on this program. That's a privilege. I also think that the lines between private and public and personal and political are constantly being reinscribed over time. And I think that it's a choice that individuals have to make. Depending on how safe they are in making those decisions on what they choose to expose about themselves. But at least personally, like, the way that I've conceptualized the account that I just gave has, like, a lot of the healing has occurred in being able to make connections between how the culture that I was born into and the expectations that are put on me through the way my body signifies in space, how that corresponds to my symptoms. And I think that's a way of finding community, and community is really essential in being able to, like, for me, reintegrate myself into a life of more normalcy, but also dealing with the fact that, like, this is an ongoing thing. So you're always a personal and political subject. You're just playing the field, like, at the same time, all the time. So, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you both for being part of a powerful episode. And I don't know the time right now. 4:26? 5:26. So we're going to take a 4-minute break, and then we will boot up for 5:30 for episode 4.